Romance, and we open that set with Eleanor Pal's recording of Got a Brand New Suit. It's a minute after four. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest is humorist Cynthia Heimel, who writes tongue-in-cheek advice columns for The Village Voice and Playboy magazine. Her pieces were first collected in the book Sex Tips for Girls. Now there's a sequel, a new collection titled But Enough About You. It's filled with her observations about life in the 80s. With Heimel as our guide, we learn that a yuppie is nothing but a preppy with a gay sensibility. And in answer to that age-old question, can you tell what kind of lover a man is by the way he dances? Heimel answers, yes, it's simple. A good dancer is never a good lover. And she reinforces our instincts to avoid polyester, but instructs us to even be suspicious of silk, a fabric which has become a cliché. Cynthia Heimel's new book, But Enough About You, is published by Simon & Schuster. She has also written a play, and her new play, A Girl's Guide to Chaos, is in previews off-Broadway. Cynthia Heimel, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we talk, I'd really like to have you read something from Enough About You. Can you open with Fear of Dating?
Fear of dating. Sure. I happen to have it right here, Terry. The realization hit me heavily, like a 44 Magnum smashing into my skull. My heart started beating with a quick dread, and my blood froze in my veins. My stomach did backflips. The ordeal I was about to face is one of the most grisly, macabre, and chilling experiences known to woman. Dating. I will have to start dating again. Please, God, no, don't make me do it. I'll be good from now on, I promise. I'll stop feeding the dog hashish. I'll be kind, thoughtful, sober, industrious, anything. But please, God, not the ultimate torture of dating. That's why I stayed with him so long, probably. I couldn't stand going through it all again. Sure, he might be a trifle wild and intractable, I kept telling myself. But at least I know I'll have sex tonight and tomorrow night. At least someone will try to go to the movies with me and not try to hold my hand. Hand-holding, the worst thing about dating. The fellow, or maybe even I, will decide that holding hands is a sweet, simple way to start. Ha! It's the most nerve-wracking experience of life. Once I start holding hands, I'm afraid to stop. If I pull my hand away, will he think I'm being cold or moody? Should I squeeze his hand and kind of wiggle my fingers around suggestively? Or is that too forward? What if we're holding hands in the movies and I have to scratch my nose? If I let his hand go and then scratch the offending nose and then don't grab his hand again immediately, will he think I'm rejecting him? Will he be relieved? What if my hand is clammy? A clammy hand is more offensive than bad breath or right-wing politics. A clammy hand means you are lousy in bed. Everybody knows that. And what, dear spiteful God, will I wear? I'll need new dresses, new jewelry, new sweaters, trousers, underwear, and shoes. Shoes tell everything. Shoes have to be perfect. Men like high heels, right? I can't walk in high heels. Well, I can try. For a really important date, I can just see myself spending $250 on a pair of drop-dead suede heels. This time, it will be different, I'll tell myself. This time, I will be able to walk. But after an hour, the ball of my foot will cramp up. I know it, and I'll hobble. Is anything wrong? He'll ask me solicitously. You're limping. And I won't know where to look. I won't be able to say, these goddamn shoes are crippling me, and if I don't take them off this minute, I'll be maimed for life. Because then he'll know that I just bought them, that I bought them to go out on a date with him. And that will make him feel weird and pressured, knowing that this date was a big deal for me. And he'll realize that maybe I'm not as popular and sophisticated as he thought I was. If I had to buy a special pair of shoes that I can't even walk in, for Christ's sakes, just for a date with him. So I'll have to explain the limping in such a way that it has nothing to do with the shoes. An old war wound? I have been known to try on outfits in an entirely tidy room, and somehow when I am finished, every single item of clothing I own is off the rack and on the floor, and then when the phone rings, there is no way on earth I can find it. I can't even find my bed. God, I hate dating. And when he rings my doorbell and my stockings are still around my ankles because my garter belt is missing, but with mad, deep, quick thought, I finally remember it's in my black satin purse. Don't ask. And I get on and get the stockings up and answer the door smiling casually. What precisely do I say? What will I talk about on a date? Not one thing that's on my mind will be a suitable topic of conversation. Do you think we'll sleep together tonight? Are you one of those guys who can't make a commitment or can only make a commitment to a woman with really smooth, finely muscled thighs? Is my deodorant working? What kind of relationship did you have with your mother? How do you think we're getting along so far? Do you like me? How much do you like me? Are you sure you really like me? Dated any junkies? Ever been plagued by impotence? You're not going out with me because you feel sorry for me, are you? No. We'll talk about the movies. What we've seen recently. What if he tells me that he finally got around to seeing Cocoon and it turned out to be one of the greatest experiences of his life? Will I pretend to agree? I bet I will. I bet something slimy inside myself will cause me to nod my head encouragingly and say, "Yes, wasn't it lovely?" And then I'll hate myself because I've turned our date into a tissue of lies. I'll become distracted thinking about what a hypocrite I really am, and my eyes will glaze over, and I'll nod absently when he tries to draw me out. And then he'll get all paranoid, thinking I hate him because he liked Cocoon. He'll be right. But what if it turns out that his favorite movie is The Man Who Came to Dinner, with Slapshot a close second? Then I could fall in love. Then I'd really be terrified.
That's Cynthia Heimel reading from her new book, But Enough About You. It's amazing how it doesn't get any easier dating.
No, I think it's harder now. I mean, I've never been able... You used to know when you were going out on a date. You used to understand what was going on. Someone would call you up and ask you to dinner in the movies, and that meant that there was romance. Now people will call you and say, want to go to dinner, want to go to the movies, and they mean nothing particular by it.
Well, it's true. You have no idea really whether it's supposed to be a sexual thing or just food.
There's a guy in Washington who's been calling me, and I want to say, listen, are we supposed to be having a romance here, or are we just friends? I mean, you don't know anymore. One time a guy asked me to walk him to his shrink, and about halfway there I realized he was serious. You never know.
Do you think that there's a scientific reason why you won't feel yourself with someone if you're not wearing clothes that you really feel good about?
I don't know. There's something about clothes. I'm obsessed with clothes. I'm not necessarily proud of it, but I have to say. And I think if you're wearing something that doesn't sort of express exactly who you feel like at the moment, you're going to be just a little bit off kilter. Others don't mind. Others will wear a sweatshirt and no problem.
Bad to wear something for the first time when you're on a special occasion, don't you think? Because you don't know if it's going to hurt after you've worn it for 2 hours.
Yeah, though, especially shoes. I mean, I really have done that. And halfway through a date, I'll start hobbling and I just want to die.
When you're going out with someone, right, will you introduce them to your son, who I assume still lives with you?
Yeah. My son still manages to put up with me. I don't really have much choice. He's usually lying on the living room floor watching MTV.
Does it become this whole thing of, well, if you and I get serious, this is the person you'll be inheriting?
I don't know, because I haven't gone out with anybody in such a long time. I lived with someone for 3 years, and that recently broke up. And when he came around, my son was on vacation. By the time my son got back, he was almost living there. But yes, that did happen when my son was younger.
So you're broken up, but you're not dating again?
Nobody wants to go out with me.
Come on.
It's true. It's
Why
true.
Is that?
I don't know. I think it might have been a big mistake writing Sex Tips for Girls. You know, because everybody starts thinking that I'm Dr. Ruth or something. It was a joke. It was a humor book. And I don't know, I was on a program today where they were talking about sex. And I thought, oh, I remember. They used to think I was a sex expert. And I'm not. I know nothing, but no, I haven't been dating.
Do men think this is going to be like championship wrestling? They'll get in the ring with the pro?
I don't know. Maybe they just think I'm ugly. I don't know. And I write that column called Women in Playboy. So, you know, I'm sure that there's some correlation there. But I have not. I can't get a date to save my life.
Do you think there's a male shortage? I've heard people complaining about that.
There is, but people are complaining about that, but it's not as bad as people think. I mean, I was so horrified by Newsweek this summer when they came out with a story about how you have a better chance of being killed by a terrorist than ever getting married. I mean, it was a very narrow-minded, strange survey which didn't take into account anything like women with younger men or women who prefer other women or women who wouldn't marry a man on a bet, you know, women who prefer chocolate. And then people did a whole cover story called Old Maids with Linda Evans on it. Linda, we're supposed to, you know, I thought that was so amazing to have Linda Evans, an old maid. Poor old thing.
They're reviving that term again, old maid.
Yeah, I think.
I guess spinster is right around the corner.
They're preying on a certain kind of fear. There's a lot of pressure right now to get married. And I really think it's a feminist backlash, and it really irritates me.
Well, you said something that kind of surprised me. You say that you think that sleeping with a man you hardly know is like skipping ahead and reading the end of a murder mystery first.
Yeah, I think if you don't know who you're sleeping with, or you just have some kind of vague notion, I'm not saying it's going to be awful or it's not going to be pleasurable, but the buildup is so important, at least for me and for the women that I know. I don't know. I think men have a more hair trigger sensibility about sex than women.
Have you ever figured out a way when you're with someone who you think, well, maybe we're going to have a sexual relationship and maybe we're not? Have you figured out a way to bring that up?
No. Have you?
No, I'd never figured
Occasionally,
out a way
to... there's only one way to do it. And once in a while I've done it. I've said, what is going on here? Are we, is this heading towards something? Are we good friends? Are we going to be closer and warmer? What's the deal? How do you feel about this? And that always works. They always say, no, are you kidding? I feel like you're my sister.
There are so many safe sex concerns now for gay and heterosexual people. And to hear some people tell it sounds like you should perform like a full genital examination on your prospective partner before deciding to have
get a note
sexual
from
relationship.
This doctor. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, from the research that a friend of mine, Emily Prager, was doing a piece on condoms for a magazine, and she talked to the San Francisco AIDS Project, and they said condoms, if used properly, are safe. If you squeeze that little bubble of air out, you don't want any air bubbles in them, and if you know how to use, I'm not going to go into it on the air, but because it embarrasses me, but I think that is really important. I mean, we are talking about our lives and survival. It's a very ironic disease, don't you think?
Yeah, how do you mean that?
Well, sex is a life force, and if you sleep with someone, you can die. So procreation can kill you. I don't know. It seems it's like an oxymoron of a disease.
Yeah, I know. I know what you mean. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Cynthia Heimel, and she's a humorist who writes for The Village Voice and for Playboy. She has a new collection of her pieces. It's called But Enough About You. You were in a relationship for 3 years, right? And then it broke up. Did you have to redefine in a way who you are? You know how personalities can blend together?
They can congeal.
Yeah, when you're living with someone you're really close, you start to share similar interests and go to the same places, sometimes have all these little in-jokes.
Mm.
And when it breaks up, you don't have that anymore.
You don't know who you are in some ways, or you'll go to a shop and you'll say, oh, he'd love that, and you're halfway buying it before you realize there's no one to buy it for. Yes, it is hard to do that, but it's also almost a relief at times to be able to lie around listening to country and Western music and reading P.G. Wodehouse books again without someone saying, what? Why aren't you studying Stone Circles, hon? And you do have to slowly rediscover your own taste in yourself.
Stone Circles, as in?
As in Stonehenge and the Callanish Stones. That's the guy I was living with was very cosmic. And interested in ley lines and things like that.
He was younger?
Yes, he was 10 years younger than me.
You wrote that you felt like you were living through Annie Hall in reverse, and
yeah.
You were Woody Allen?
Yeah, I was always trying to say, no, come on, there are some good black and white movies. And what do you mean you don't know who Julie Christie is? And here, read this. You'll like this. And it was, I felt like I had to sort of, I was a cynical kind of goofy, humorous one, and he was sort of more naive and ingenuous. So it was a funny relationship. But women with younger men seems to, I think it should work.
Did you ever feel like he was treating you like a mother? Did that ever?
Well, no more than any other man does. They can be 50, it's still the same thing.
Some people say that older woman, younger man evens out the power balance, since men in society still have more power.
Yeah.
Than women do. So if the woman's older, by virtue of her added wisdom through the years, things are more easily evened out within a relationship.
That sounds good, but I don't think that's necessarily the case at all.
You don't?
No, I think each individual couple has their own power situation going for them. And it doesn't really matter if they're men or women necessarily.
Did it make you feel older or younger to be with someone 10 years younger?
Older. I mean, it's not really, you do feel suddenly like an ancient creaky hag in a way. When you're with someone so much younger, it doesn't really. Men I know seem to like younger women because it makes them feel youthful. I guess what I guess the part they like is the fact that someone young and beautiful will find them attractive. And that is very nice. There's nothing wrong with that, but it seems sort of trivial to me. A minor point.
Would it bother you when your lover wouldn't know your favorite doo-wop record from the late 1950s or, you know, your favorite sitcoms from the early 1960s?
Yeah, there are. I mean, not so much that the obvious fact that he wouldn't know Mary Tyler Moore. He was also a foreigner. He's from New Zealand. But that if I said a Mary Tyler Moore joke in the middle of, you know, made a strange allusion to Chuckles the Clown, he wouldn't have any idea of what I was talking about. So my little, you know, a lot of jokes are about culture.
That's right.
So I'd say something that was devastating to me, and he'd look at me like, what's for dinner, hon? There was no, you know, that was a problem. Yeah.
Do you like living alone with your son, you know, as opposed to living in a coupled relationship?
I like living with people, too. I become almost bovine when I live with someone. I'm very content, and I I say, would you like a cup of tea? And I'm, you know, like to bustle around. And it's different just living with my son, and it's like a roommate situation. We're real pals, and we hang out together, and it's very wild. We have pillow fights and stuff.
Cynthia Heimel, I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of another one of your pieces from your collection, But Enough About You. Can you read part of We Are Not What We Wear?
Sure. Want to be cool, with it, up-to-date, fashionable, on the cutting edge. Want to have drop-dead clothes, a chic look, an impeccable image. Sorry, can't be done. It is no longer fashionable to be fashionable. The more we try, the more we are destined for failure. We will be met with scorn and branded old hat, gauche, and bad form. If we're trendy, we're twits, and no one will want to chat with us at the laundromat. Here's why. Back in the old days when artists used to live in lofts, if one had a look, it meant something. Some looks proclaimed, hi there, I'm a rock star, or hello, I'm a black humorist, or even yo, I'm a drug dealer. This made things easy. If you, an artist, were walking down the street, wearing possibly black tights and paint-spattered multicolored rags, and coming toward you was another vision in black tights, etc., you could say to yourself, there's another artist coming toward me, and you'd be right. You would then be reminded that you are a member of a peer group, which would put a jaunty spring in your step. But now dentists and people with hyphenated names live in lofts in places like Soho, New York, and downtown L.A., and hundreds of thousands of square feet, once places where people in multicolored rags would peer with intense dislike at canvases, then grab a tube of vermilion, squish it around on a palette, rush at the canvas and make a few decisive dabs, view their handiwork and go all mournful again. Now they're used. These same lofts are used to showcase the perfect bit of deco, a museum-quality collection of stickly armchairs, or the dernier cri in Memphis furniture. Lofts are no longer arenas in which to be incessantly creative. Dentists and people with hyphenated names have made them into status symbols and are wearing multicolored rags, and nothing is what it seems. Here's what else we can't wear: rockstar regalia. Even rock stars wouldn't be caught dead in studded leather, a cross hanging from one ear and a bandana tied around the biceps. Neither would they ever think of appearing in brocade velvet and ruffled shirts with impeccable makeup and their hair tied back in a ponytail. They know too well that in either case, people would just mistake them for hairdressers. Sci-fi futurist garb, including jumpsuits with enormously padded shoulders and modified Nehru collars, is not worn by spacemen or astronomers, but instead by persons who say they are video producers. When they actually find time to produce these rock videos is beyond me, since these specimens are invariably found passing joints in deserted corners of rock clubs. Anyone who tells us he's a video producer is simply ashamed to say he's between jobs. 50s clothing is only worn by children who are not around at the time. Designer clothing is worn unceasingly by social climbers. Designer sweatsuits are worn by poor social climbers. Athletic outfits are not worn by athletes who inexplicably wear designer jeans, but by psychologists and holistic practitioners intent upon striving for excellence. The post-nuclear look is shunned by survivors of Hiroshima, but adopted by second-class rock musicians who like to watch themselves on MTV. Where does that leave us? With nothing to wear, that's where. If this were not a democracy, we could force dentists and hairdressers back into their white coats and devise special uniforms for all agents and rock video producers. But alas, they will have to have their sartorial freedom, whether the rest of us wish it or not. In this time of rampant posing, we must with dignity withdraw from the fray and simply never let our clothing make a statement. It just doesn't have a big enough vocabulary.
That's great. That's Cynthia Heimel from her new book, But Enough About You. What's your style?
I don't know. I'm wearing today a cowboy shirt. I'm sort of trying to look like Patsy Cline at the moment, I think.
Not very convincing.
No, no. I'm alive. I like old clothes. I like clothes in the 40s and the 30s, and I try and find things like that. The clothes that I like now are more expensive than I can personally afford, and I love a hand-knit sweater, so I'm learning how to knit them myself, because hand-knit sweaters cost about as much as an Isuzu.
Is shopping a pleasurable experience for you?
Yeah, I really, it is. I think I have to join Shoppers Anonymous. You know, I really do. It's like, it makes me think I might be turning into a yuppie. I feel that kind of yuppie tentacles sort of insinuating themselves into my brain. Because buying things can make one feel safer, more secure. And at the moment, the world is so weird that we want to feel safer and more secure. So we end up, you know, going to, I live around the corner from a place called Barney's where you can spend $1,000 on a nightgown. And I'll take a walk and suddenly I'll find myself in Barney's, you know, coveting shoes that really cost as much as a car. And it seems to be the disease of the times, buying things. You notice this?
Well, are you worried about it?
In my own case?
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that, I mean, I know how silly I am and I know when to laugh at myself and I try and do that as much as possible. So, you know, I'll just write about it.
Do you judge people by what they wear?
Oh, I look at shoes immediately. Let me see your shoes, Terry.
Here you go. What can you tell about me?
Be
frank, I can take it.
Well, I would prefer actual holes as opposed to what are those little tabs that you have your lace? They're black lace-up shoes, but they're not the classic black lace-up shoes. They're a little racier, a little too racy for me, but kind of, they're nice. I mean, I would never look at you and think, I don't want to know her.
You want to mention that they're ankle-high?
Oh, they're ankle-high lace-up boots. Yeah, they're not, she's not, they're not thigh-high. She's not carrying a whip.
What, I mean, when you see a man with his suit jacket sleeves pushed up to the elbow, that style,
what
does it make you think?
I want to throw up. I mean,
That's very fashionable. Why don't you like it?
It's completely posing. It's really superficial and stupid. And it's the same thing as, you know, that when they put their collars up, when they put their sports jacket collars up, they just look absolutely absurd. I don't know why men do this.
What about, you know, that new kind of male, maybe it's not so new, the male bikini turquoise underwear, you know, like designer underwear for men?
I think that's sort of endearing. It's not, I mean, I don't prefer it necessarily, but I think it's more endearing than the yuppie boxer shorts look, that kind of, you know, the
yuppie boxer shorts?
Yeah, I think yuppies are wearing those kind of Brooks Brother baggy boxer shorts these days. This is my impression anyway. Not that I've ever seen a yuppie without his trousers on, but I, from what I hear, that's what they buy. Pima cotton.
Uh-huh. I'm informed that long hair is coming back in for men.
Coming?
It's in already. So you could tell by the shoes I'm really behind the times.
No, it's just, I think that New York is usually in hair lengths, starts out about 6 months before everywhere else, and men have lots of long hair. Ponytails.
How did this happen? The ponytails are back.
I don't know.
It's
a sort of a Regency look. We're going back to the 19th century.
What does the ponytail signify now? It can't signify hippie anymore.
Well, it's not exactly hippie, but I do think it's fashion is always kind of pendulum-like, and short hair was very strong for a long time. Long hair is, you know, desperados, cowboys, gamblers in the 19th century. That kind of thing. I think it's men are becoming much more vain openly than they used to. I mean, men have always been vain. My last boyfriend used to look in the toaster. He'd pass by and he couldn't stop himself. He'd have to peek in.
If he was really vain, he would have kept a bigger mirror in the kitchen.
Yeah. Well, no, it was my kitchen. I didn't have a mirror in there. And they are. My son will spend 15 minutes fixing his hair before going out to buy groceries. But I think men are more overtly vain, and rock and roll sort of plays up the kind of peacock in a man, which is fine with me.
Why are you on a crusade against down jackets?
You've noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
I've changed my mind. I know I've written this whole thing. I don't like down jackets because I got really fed up with them. You know how there's a surfeit of it, especially those long down coats in that sort of muddy purple color. They're just, every single person had a kind of mauvey, gray, browny, long down coat. And I just thought, if I see another one of those, I'm going to have to go blind. But I think a little khaki down jacket for when it's extremely cold outside is perfectly acceptable. I like it better than a fur coat.
Okay. What about fake fur?
Fake fur is okay. But real fur is dumb because you can't ever leave it anywhere without worrying that you're going to get it stolen. And I just don't like fur.
My guest is Cynthia Heimel. She has a new collection called But Enough About You. And I'm going to ask you to read. You run under several persona. You know, you're the problem lady. You have Sister Soignier. And I'm going to ask you to read one of the Dear Sister Soignier letters and responses.
Okay. Here's one I like. Dear Sister Soignier, something tells me I'm turning into a superficial person. I've noticed that when I wake up and put on an old sweatsuit, my whole day is shot. I shamble around feeling negative and end up at home late that night eating a Salisbury steak TV dinner. And I really don't like Salisbury steak much. The scenario changes drastically when I spiff myself up. My step is springy, my outlook is sunny, and I often find myself making sparkling conversation with a cute girl from accounting when we meet at the water cooler. I end my day at a chic bistro, often with that same cute girl. I'm annoyed with myself. Outward appearance shouldn't mean so much. Why should I feel better simply because I'm wearing a dove gray cashmere sweater? Isn't it the inner man that counts? James. Dear James, let me say with all due respect that if you were a woman, you wouldn't talk such drivel. Only last week I was wandering about in a slough of despair. I couldn't find an outfit that made my hips look narrower than those of a smallish hippopotamus. I was inconsolable until I happened to come upon in my closet a long black skirt already dry cleaned. My spirits soared. There is nothing silly about this. Frivolous, yes, but frivolity is a necessity of life. Only men are under the mistaken impression that the personality radiates outward. We women have always known that the reverse is true. Why do you think we crave beautiful shoes to show off our feet? No. We know that with ugly shoes on, we won't be able to paint that masterpiece or write the great American novel or even remember to take the clothes out of the dryer. Stop being upset with yourself. You have stumbled upon a truth of the ages, Sister Soignier.
That's great.
It's my philosophy of life.
Well, let me ask you. When you're home and you know that no one's going to be, or you assume that no one's going to be stopping in to see you or anything, do you wear clothes that you like, or do you save those clothes, protect them from just the housewear, and wear the stuff that you wish you'd never bought, or those gifts, sweaters or pants that don't really fit and they're colors you hate, you know, really horrible looking clothes. What do you wear around home when you're
around
just working?
The house? A nightgown. I don't get dressed at all. No.
I can't make the decision.
No, it's just that I can't be bothered to get dressed unless I have to, you know, somebody comes to the door, I have to go out. I have two modes of dressing, and one is absolutely plain. You know, the plainest jeans, baggy jeans and sweatshirts or flannel shirts or things that I really like. And if I'm just going to wander around the house, it's usually, you know, plain. But really, it's really usually a nightgown.
Do you ever have to get dressed in certain clothes to get into one of your writing personas to really feel like Sister Soignier or like the problem lady?
Nah, I don't have to do that. I just sort of close my eyes and turn into another person. When I was a reporter, I used to have to dress up in different ways, but that's a different story.
Okay. There's one more,
Sister
piece of
Soignier
advice that I'm going to ask you to give. Whoops, wrong page. There we go.
Okay.
Is that it?
Yeah. Sister Soignier again. Dear Sister Soignier, can a person be a rampant left-wing socialist sort of a guy and still wear stylish clothes? I went to a union meeting the other day wearing a really incredible Catherine Hammett jumpsuit, and consequently nobody would talk to me. This doesn't seem fair. I like to dress up. Jeffrey. Dear Jeffrey, politicos who look askance at the stylish clothing are harboring an unsavory nostalgia for the 60s. Back then, if you weren't wearing a slightly stained ribbed turtleneck and jeans with lumpy pockets that bagged at the ass, you had no credibility. Clothes were a political statement during the 60s, which was too bad since it kept all clothes horses from attending those tedious committee meetings and endless marches where they would have brightened the proceedings considerably. Being smart and festive is your God-given right, except if you're wearing a cashmere blazer with brass buttons and tasseled loafers, in which case you can only expect people to point and laugh. Sister Soignée.
This leads to the question, since you've addressed the question, can you be a leftist and still care about fashion? Can a feminist wear high heels?
Well, I do, but I hobble after an hour. Yes, a feminist can wear high heels. I think it actually is a contradiction to do so, because you can't run in high heels, and sometimes you have to.
You can barely walk
you
in high heels.
Some people can walk better than others, but you just have to be playful. I just think humor and funniness and playing around is... I don't think you should ever wear high heels as a uniform or just, to go to work every day. Although I really think I prefer high heels to running shoes and A-line skirts. But as a costume, as an outfit, as something fun, I do like to wear high heels. And I don't think that there is anything non-feminist about wanting to be attractive to men. What I wonder is why men find women attractive in high heels. Some of them say it's because it kind of throws our body into more interesting shape. But I wonder if it's not the sort of helplessness.
But it also means going through a certain amount of suffering to make yourself attractive.
Yeah. I won't suffer. I'll only wear high heels when I know I'm going to be sitting most of the evening. I don't think you should ever suffer to make yourself attractive. It's sort of you won't look attractive anyway. It won't work because you'll be in pain.
Do you ever have conflicts, though, between your feminism and your feelings about clothes and, what you should wear to be attractive?
No, I don't. I think that everybody's allowed to be frivolous. One of my best friends and my editor at The Voice is Mary Peacock, who is the best dresser that I've ever known. I've never seen anyone dress with such style. And she was an editor at Ms. from the days that it started. She was, I don't see that there's a contradiction in caring about something to the point of mania, which Mary and I both do. We both write about clothes. We know about clothes. We know about designers. I can look at a pair of shoes and say, oh, that's Robert Clergerie, and know it from two blocks away. And I don't see anything non-feminist about that. I know that there are feminist stereotypes that we're all supposed to, be very plain and have uncurly hair. Look almost mannish. I don't think that women are trying to be men when they're feminists.
And to you, clothes is theatrical too.
Yeah, it's play acting. It's an obsession. Let's face it, Terry.
Okay,
I have to.
I'm going to change the subject a second and ask you if you have a couple of coins handy. Do you have a purse with you? Because in a few minutes, I want to cast your lowlife I Ching. And if you don't have coins, we'll have to go get some.
Okay.
No. I'm going to ask our engineer who's listening now if she could find us two pennies so we can cast Cynthia Heimel's oracle. And once we get the pennies, I'll explain, or you'll explain,
yeah.
Better yet, what the oracle is.
Okay.
In the meantime, you have something that you call the sitcom way of being. And I find this really a very useful way to look at life.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work.
No, well, it's very hard to keep... I think the civilization at the moment is more like a soap opera.
We're getting the coins.
Oh, coins are coming. Hello. But,
You going to read from some of it?
No.
Refresh your memory.
I'm just kind of looking. Yeah, I'm just looking at the book. I like to... I was paraphrasing Tolstoy. I'll just read the first little tiny line. All happy families live a situation comedy. All unhappy families live a soap opera. This is the sad truth. The happy truth is that you get to choose. Take my life, please. and there have been times when my son has, by accident, dropped his report card out the window, and at the same time, my boyfriend brought an entire football team to sleep on the living room floor. My mother's decided that, I have to get to Philadelphia immediately. My sister wants me to come up to Boston. My friends are all breaking up with their boyfriends, and everything is happening at once. And at the time... there are two ways of feeling. One is, I can't bear this anymore. I think I'll just curl up and die. Or divide your life into half-hour segments and give yourself plenty of time for commercial breaks and listen to the laugh track in your mind. And you've got a sitcom. Your entire life can turn into a sitcom. And if you write it up, put it into script form, you can make $1 million. So I think the sitcom way of being is like possibly a very revolutionary idea.
Which sitcom do you try to be like?
My favorite sitcom is George Burns and Gracie Allen, the Burns and Allen show. I try and be like that as much as possible. Mary Tyler Moore is another very important sitcom. Cheers is kind of cute. And right now my son and I are watching Perfect Strangers.
Which one's that? Is that about the one person who's foreign, yeah, one person's American, yeah, and they're roommates? Or?
Mm-hmm. And so he half the time talking to him, he turns into that guy, Balky, who's the foreign guy.
Your son does?
Yeah. So we do live the sitcom way of being 24 hours a day.
Okay. My guest is Cynthia Heimel, and she is a columnist for The Village Voice and Playboy, and has a new collection of pieces titled But Enough About You. One of the great innovations in your book is a new oracle. I've cast this once before, and I want to do it again now. In order to understand the lowlife I Ching, first you should explain the I Ching, and then we'll explain your variation on this ancient oracle.
The I Ching is something that even C.G. Jung thinks is very exciting. So, you know, I feel that I'm not a complete loony. It's a huge book that is a fortune teller. You consult the oracle when you have major decisions to make, and you take three coins, you throw them six times, and you come up with a hexagram. And the hexagram can be anything from, the army, and it will, you know, it'll tell you that from now on you're going to have a pretty rough time and you better gather your forces together. And everything the I Ching says, even if you don't see how it applies to your life, you usually do, it's usually uncannily accurate, but it gives you wonderful wisdom and wonderful advice. It's a book that you can just read anyway because it's full of important and spiritual and healing messages, and I love it.
If it's that good, why do we need another oracle?
Because there are people who misuse it. There are people who abuse the oracle and need to go to I Ching Anonymous. That's my new, I don't know, I'm into that joke today. So there are people who can't get up in the morning and decide what color sweater to wear. Or do they want to go to a party or they want to stay at work? I mean, there's all these little tiny decisions that can plague our days. And it's really insulting to the real I Ching to ask, well, do you think I should wear my plaid skirt? So what I've done with great reverence is I've thrown the coins several millions of times to ask the big I Ching what the low-life I Ching should say. And I went through it hexagram by hexagram. So this is not me talking. This is me reinterpreting, yes, okay, I had to ask, but I asked the oracle how to construct the low-life I Ching, and it told me. And it works. People use it all the time.
Well, I'm going to use it now.
Yeah, we're going to do it? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
So I have to think of something like really trivial that would be demeaning for the I Ching if I asked it to the I Ching.
Yeah, you don't want to.
Unworthy of that. So, okay, here's my question. I'm really busy and I just don't have a lot of time. But in my apartment, I've been trying to decide, should I paint the walls or not? Should I live with canary yellow in the kitchen and a pale mint green in the bedroom and living room? Or should I spend the time and money to make it something like an off-white? Right.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I personally think you should paint, but let's see what the oracle.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't. Wanna
I didn't
live
paint
in,
it those colors.
I wouldn't want to live in a mint green kitchen.
The canary yellow kitchen. Oh. Mint green bedroom and living room. Is this trivial enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I cast the coins four times.
Yeah.
Okay. One, and I got two tails, so that's a
straight line.
Straight line. Two, head and tail. That's broken line. Three. Head and tail, another broken line. Four, another head and tail.
Okay, so here, where are we?
So we have three broken lines going from up to down, three broken lines and a solid line.
Okay, that's hexagram number 9. I'll just look that up here. Let's see what it says.
What is it?
It's got nothing to do with your problem at all. It says romantic attachment. Is somebody moving in with you?
Not that I know of.
It says, draw up a guest list, remember your goals, things could get exciting. A powerful attraction is burgeoning. Go out, celebrate, show off a loved one to best friends, have a party. Don't let yourself be scared off, yield to your deeper feelings, and don't be influenced by social climbers and status seekers. They will lead you astray with whispered words of empty flattery. Affection will triumph. Don't play games, play it straight from the gut, don't get Byzantine. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't work at all. I don't see how this. I don't see how this relates even slightly. Except it sounds like maybe you are going to have a romantic attachment that... maybe you were asking it a different question.
You're putting the blame on me.
Yeah,
your oracle doesn't answer my question.
My oracle says I'm not gonna answer a question on the radio.
Yeah, but anyways, you think I should paint?
Yeah. I think you have to. I don't think there's any choice about it. How can you live in a mint green bedroom?
Oh, my guest is Cynthia Heimel, and she writes for The Village Voice and for Playboy, and The Lowlife I Ching, which I just cast.
With no success at all, is
featured in her book. So
you tried at home. Kids, don't try this at home.
could be dangerous and misleading. You write for Playboy, and you write for The Village Voice. Do you ever have to defend yourself to feminist friends about writing in Playboy?
No, but everyone always asks me that question. No one has ever said, how could you write for Playboy? But everyone says, do you ever have to, you know, do you ever get any trouble for... It's such a wonderful job to me. I mean, I get the chance to wag my finger at 12 million men and say, stop doing that, stop evading commitment, start paying child support. I've written about gynecology. I've said, okay, guys, this is what it's like to go to the gynecologist. I've written about PMS, explained PMS so that they would know when to be nice to us. Oh, I heard a new phrase lately, PMS envy. What do you think? Guys are really mad that they can't have PMS when they can be cranky and moody and burst into tears.
Or maybe even stay home a couple extra hours.
Yeah, right. Say they have cramps. But Playboy, to me, is a wonderful opportunity, a wonderful forum. Not only that, it pays the rent. You know, it. I like
which I'm sure
Playboy.
The Village Voice probably doesn't. I doubt they pay very...
They don't pay... they don't pay as much as Playboy. And at this point in history, I'm proud of working for Playboy. I mean, especially ever since they've been taken out of the 7-Elevens, which I think is appalling. This anti-pornography stance taken by these hypocrites like me have just made people more fervent in their love for this kind of magazine. I can have total freedom to say whatever I want in Playboy. They've never said, stop being such a feminist. They've never said, stop being so harsh on men. They've been very kind and very supportive.
You're really so funny on sex and fashion and things along those lines, relationships. Do you ever wish that you were writing about the burning issues of our times, war and peace and toxic waste and nuclear weapons and scandals in the White House?
Yeah. I feel inadequate all the time when I'm writing. I feel like, well, I'm just this writing about humor and writing about the things I know, and I should start studying more and learning more, but... it's very hard to be a political humorist. I know very few people who know how to do it because you get so wrapped up in it and so carried away with it. Occasionally I will write about the burning issues. I know that I'm going to write a Playboy column that's going to be very political and I hope surprising to people because it's not going to be about relationships at all. I'm not going to tell you what it is.
I figured, yeah, because you'd worry that I'd go out and write it and scoop you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or I'll scoop myself by, you know, talking about it on the air. But I think I'm beginning to feel that I must be more overtly political again because I'm getting so angry about things right now. I was very political last decade. I was a community organizer for several years.
Really? Yeah. Doing what kind of work?
Tenants organizations. In London, in England, I was organizing in South London, getting buildings torn down, getting daycare centers built, getting playgrounds built, just organizing communities. And I really, when I came back to this country, I found it an almost impossible kind of job, especially for a woman. I was told that I was not allowed. I was hired as a community organizer at one place and then told I wasn't allowed to leave the office. I had to stay and type letters and file. So I'm sure things are not that way everywhere, but it is a very hard job to have in this country.
How did you start writing?
I used to distribute the Distant Drummer. Do you remember that newspaper in the late 60s?
In Philadelphia?
Yeah, I'm from Philadelphia. And one day I stumbled upon the Temple University riots and I phoned up the office and I said, you've got to send a reporter down here. The students are rioting. And they said, and I quote, cover it. And I said, who, me? And they said, you. And that's how I started writing. I had no notion of being a writer before that.
It sounds like the Corinne, who has to become the leading lady because the leading lady broke her leg.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. It was like, who knew?
So you were good? They liked that piece?
Yeah, they liked the piece a lot, yeah. I still have it somewhere. It's not bad. I've been reading so much Tom Wolfe that, you know, I...
Which one?
Not Thomas, Tom, you know, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and that stuff. And I was very derivative. I mean, there was no question about where I was getting a lot of my style. But I've been reading so much that I think I had the ability to write and didn't know it. I mean, all I did through my entire childhood was read. I never went out to play.
What kind of stuff did you read?
Anything I could get my hands on. I mean, not mighty tomes, but Nancy Drew, you know, Bobbsey Twins when I was little, romances, mysteries, novels.
How did you figure out that you could be funny in print, that you could be a good humorist? If you started out reporting.
That piece was kind of funny. I mean, it's really hard to explain how that stuff happens. I don't even know how to articulate it. I just try and amuse myself when I write. And people laughed and said, that's funny, that's good. And so I realized that when I first started writing, and I wrote for the Soho Weekly News, and then I worked for New York Magazine and the Daily News before I stopped having a job somewhere, I had to make my living by writing movie star profiles and things like that. But I knew that I just wanted to be a humorist, and I just kept working towards that goal and just sort of keeping my sights on the day when I could finally stop interviewing Jane Fonda and start writing about silliness.
What was your breakthrough?
Quitting the Daily News and starting a column in the Village Voice. They both happened around the same time.
That's a column you still do?
Yeah. In 1981, I started really doing columns. And I wrote a book, and that really helps.
Is there a big barrier at the Village Voice between the people who write about the serious issues and the people who write about fashion and sex? Are you in two different camps?
There's probably 27 different camps.
Yeah, what am I thinking?
Voice,
sure.
You know, but there definitely is a front of the book, which is the political stuff, and a back of the book chasm. They don't get along too well. I won't say some of the nicknames that they give each other, but it gets pretty, you know, there are so many factions there that it's incredibly interesting. It is a soap opera at the Village Voice.
Well, have you been part of the club scene at all? I'm such an outsider to that, and I've interviewed here on the show several people who've written, you know, books about the club scene or who?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, fiction, Paul Rudnick.
Oh, yeah.
And
Jay McInerney wrote about it.
Michael Musto, the downtown book.
Isn't he cute?
Yeah, he mentions you in the book, doesn't he?
Yeah, he mentions me briefly in the book as a model at the PCA, because that's how I met Steven Sabin, who's another one of those chroniclers. I know a lot about it because Steven Sabin, who writes incessantly and writes a huge column in Details magazine, and it's called The Godfather of Downtown, is been my friend for 20 years and probably the closest friend I have, so I know everything.
Do you know it secondhand, or do you know it because you've hung out there a lot?
I've hung out there somewhat. It depends. You know, I go prowling around sometimes when I'm lonely and weird. I'll go out at night. I can't do it too long because it's not exactly what I have in mind for a social life.
I guess to me, one of the great mysteries about the downtown scene is how come people who are in that club scene that has these exclusive lists and you're secretly let in, like people who are really fashionable and of the moment are let in, and other people languish outside hoping someday they'll be on the list. And then there's the VIP room and then the room for everybody else. Mm. How can those people make fun of yuppies? You know, as if yuppies are materialistic and strivers and they're not.
Well, I think that it's permissible. It is absolutely an exercise in humiliation to go to a club and sort of plead to be let in and go into VIP rooms. But it's play. It's yuppies actually, I think, can cause damage. I've seen them cause damage. I've seen them buy up buildings and evict poor families and luncheonette owners and people who have had tailor shops for 75 years. And a yuppie will say, well, too bad. I am going to put in a tulip shop, and I am going to charge $10 a stem for tulips. VIP rooms, is like high school cafeteria time, all those nightclubs. It's silly and it's absolutely elitist and snobby, but there's no real repercussions in real life. Michael Musto is certainly never going to evict a florist as long as he lives. I think he's adorable. I love Michael. I've known him ever since he started writing to me at the Soho News. It's been a long time.
I should get you to elaborate on your statement that Yuppie is just preppy with a gay sensibility.
Well, did you ever notice where all those trappings that yuppies have start in the gay community? I've noticed, like, you know, the pale pink napkins and the raspberry vinegar and designer gym outfits and fern restaurants. Gay people usually have impeccable taste. This is a stereotype. I'm sorry, guys. But gays are flamboyant and interesting, and yuppies just want things. So they just adopt other people's taste.
You allude in But Enough About You, your new book, to a period when you would snort cocaine and swallow Quaaludes and have a nap in your dinner.
Yeah.
How serious is that, that allusion? Serious.
Yeah. I mean, it's the end of the day, and I probably shouldn't actually admit to it, but it is true. It's totally true, and I don't take drugs now. I think cocaine turns you into a moron. I don't think anybody should do cocaine anymore. But we've all had our wild youth, and I do, you know, I have a sort of anti-authoritarian streak, as it's fairly wide and large and long, and it seemed that taking drugs was somehow part of that, although in some ways it was also thwarted. I mean, any sort of counterculture was thwarted by so much drug taking.
Was this recent or...
Oh, how long ago was I taking drugs?
What date was it?
When was it? Not for years. I'm not going to even say how many.
Yeah, that's okay. Do you know a lot of people who are still involved with that who you think have a problem, although they might not think so?
I think it's very interesting that now I know more people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous than take drugs. And it seems that it's a real... I think it's good. I think it's a positive thing. Maybe I'm just becoming more puritanical as I'm getting older, but I think alcoholics are dangerous to themselves and sometimes to other people and really unhappy. And it is a disease, and I think it's not pleasant to be around them. They talk too much. They slobber too much. You can't believe a thing they say.
My guest is Cynthia Heimel, and she's a columnist in The Village Voice and in Playboy. She's a humorist. Her new book is titled But Enough About You, Avoiding Fabulousness, which leads me to the question of what is fabulousness, a question which I have not gotten around to asking you.
Well, fabulousness is going to these fabulous nice clubs, going to these fabulous restaurants, kissing the fabulous maitre d' on both cheeks, riding in a fabulous limo, wearing fabulous clothes, saying fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. Oh, darling, isn't that fabulous? Oh, isn't that book fabulous? I mean, I've heard the word fabulous more times in the past 5 years than I have heard any word in my life. It seems to be an epidemic, and it's like a cancer, you know, fabulous. I don't think this is the greed decade. I think this is the fabulous decade.
So most people aren't saying neat. There's
neat or cool. You know, neat or cool is, it sort of connotes a certain amount of control, but fabulous is bigger, better, faster, wilder, louder. And I think it's the wrong tack to take in 1986.
We have a couple of seconds left. Tell me a little bit about your new play that's in rehearsals now off Broadway.
It's in previews.
Previews, I mean, yeah.
It's directed by Wynn Hanman at the American Place Theater, and Wynn Hanman is the greatest director on earth, I think. Yeah, he is. He's real good. The only star you probably would have heard of is Rita Jenrette.
She plays
Rita.
Right?
You know, I have a character in my books called Rita, and Rita Jenrette is Rita. And, you know, she's
real. This is the breakthrough she's been looking for.
Yeah, she's very excited. She is very happy to be doing this. And it also stars Deborah Jo Rupp and Mary Portzer and Eric Booth, who's a descendant from John Wilkes.
Is this based on your columns?
Some of it, yeah. There's some sex tips in it and some of the new books in it and a lot of stuff that's written. It's got a sort of a story. It's got a plot or two, and it's a theatrical piece.
Yeah.
It's not a review. It's not a musical. It's You know, they're characters, and they're the same characters all the way through it.
And it's called A Girl's Guide to Chaos.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. Cynthia Heimel, it's really been fun to have you here. Thanks a lot,
Terry,
for coming.
Thank you.
Cynthia Heimel has been my guest. Her new book, which is a collection of her recent pieces, is titled But Enough About You, Avoiding Fabulousness, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. You can also read her work in The Village Voice and in Playboy, the new book again, But Enough About You. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
4 minutes to five is the time. All Things Considered is coming up at five from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening next week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon. If you're driving eastbound over the Ben Franklin Bridge, a minor delay through the tolls, and the eastbound Walt Whitman is slowing 1/4 mile through the toll plaza. Eastbound Schuylkill Expressway, 10 minutes between Montgomery and Spring Garden, and you're going to find some slowing westbound from 30th through Vine Street. Northbound 95 is running with a half mile backup at Woodhaven. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm Priscilla Fox on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Quality Plus Ford Dealers. I want to remind you that Monday, beginning at 8:30 here on 91 FM, we're going to carry special hearings from the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. And the subject will be the information on the Iran-Contra arms deal. And testifying will be former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane and Secretary of State George Shultz. Shultz begins testimony at 8:30. McFarlane is scheduled to begin testifying at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we are expecting a good deal of Monday's morning and afternoon programming to be preempted for these hearings. We don't know exactly how long they're going to run. We can't really tell you if there's going to be a lunch break or whatever, but I'm sure they'll be very interesting. So again, they begin at 8:30. Monday morning, House Committee on Foreign Affairs hearings with testimony from George Shultz and Robert McFarlane. Well, this Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Robert Bauman, former Republican congressman from Maryland, and we'll discuss how he was dragged out of the closet and forced to confront his homosexuality after he was busted for soliciting a male stripper. Tuesday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Blair Sable, author of The Body America, which will give an insider's view of the fitness explosion. 4 o'clock, we'll feature an interview with Robert B. Parker, who writes the Spencer detective novels from which the TV series is based. And Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll feature a National Press Club address with James Baldwin. And Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Dusko Doder, the Moscow bureau chief of the Washington Post from 1981 to 85. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Joyce Lieberman was the engineer today, assistance from Marty Moscoen. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. If you'd like to write to us, the address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
From the earliest plans for the